Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. After the Second World War, the Allies launched an initiative to rid German and Austrian society of any remnants of National Socialism. It was called denazification. Clarence Hamilton, better known as Claire Hamilton, a University of Iowa law graduate, was the man in charge of denazification of the German state of Bavaria and reestablishing the post-war court system there. His daughter is Judy Hamilton Crockett. She joins me now to talk about her father's work in post-war Germany, among other things. We'll also talk about his life and his heroic deeds in World War I. Judy Hamilton Crockett, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
We want to mention that today you're giving a talk at the University of Iowa College of Law titled Memories of a Nuremberg Judge, all about your father. I'm sure it'll be a fascinating talk. We're going to get a little glimpse of what you'll be talking about. If we could, let's start during World War II. Your father graduated from the University of Iowa Law School in 1921. He served in World War I. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. He reenlisted at the age of 50 to serve in World War II. Tell us about what was he assigned to do.
Well, he went to Fort Custer in Michigan and had studies there. And after 6 weeks, he was chosen by a group of Army people. There were 1,000 men chosen, and he was one of 15 finally selected to go to a very intense military government training program. And he went back to the East Coast to Yale, and he was there. And then he went to England and spent quite a bit of time in England going through this very special training for because the civil administration planning for Europe was started if the Allies won the war, probably 2 years before the end of the war. And so the occupation of Germany and Austria left the victorious armies of the United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, and France responsible for the civilian populations of Germany and Austria. And that's where Dad worked, was getting them all ready to take the government or the court systems back.
Mm-hmm. So here we have Germany in ruins, much of Europe, continental Europe in ruins, but mostly Germany in ruins. The court system that was used by the Nazis was a farce. The Allies had the chore of rebuilding or building a court system that we would recognize in the Western world.
Yes, sir.
And so what was your father's role in doing that?
Well, he was one of two that went into the city of Nuremberg on April 20th, 1945, which was actually Hitler's birthday. And he wrote that the town was in rubble, that when they arrived, they were still fighting on the inside of the big wall, but that there were some Germans who came in up and used their broadcasting system out of their truck to try to convince people to stop fighting. And people were being cleared out of the buildings and all, and then he and this other man went in and they started finding places to have officers when they came in to live. Dad lived in a bombed out building for 7 days with no water, no heat, no electricity, and just only a hose to use to wash their face and shave out of using their helmets. Mm-hmm. His letters are fascinating for the specifics that he wrote us.
So really right there at the beginning in the ashes of World War II,
yes.
Even before the fighting had completely ended there. And at this point, does he have the challenge to set up a court system, or did he have...
That was his pre-assigned duties,
mm-hmm.
To go in.
Okay. And so how does he talk about that time? How did he talk about that time? Your father died in 1975. What do you remember him telling you about that time coming into Germany in that state?
You know, to be very honest with you, Dad didn't want to talk about it. He wanted to not answer very many questions. It was a stressful time in his life that he was finished with, and it was very hard to get him into a conversation about it. So most of the information I have has come from his letters. I remember telling him at one time, Dad, I think it'd be wonderful if you would take Mother over to see London and Paris and some of the things you got to see. And he looked at me and said, Judy, I've crossed that ocean 4 times. I'm never crossing it again.
Wow. That was interesting. So some things that he kept himself to himself right until his death, many things.
Oh, yes. I wish I could now, after having read all of these letters that he sent us for 2.5 years, I wish I could ask him about the death camps and some of the different things, you know, that I now know about, that when he came back at the age of 7.5 and through my growing up, I never thought to ask him.
Of course, Nuremberg, we connect with the post-war trials, a series of military tribunals there. Was your father in any way connected with those?
It's very interesting that you should ask that, because Truman selected Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson to be in charge of the ally procedure for setting up those trials. And I have a booklet from the Robert Jackson Museum in New York, which says that they had decided on July 7th, 1945, all of the things that would be done within the trials. But it said that they were going to be leaving in the next day or two to go try to find a spot for where they would hold these. And Daddy's letter on July 8th, one day later, says, "Oh, I was just interrupted from writing to you because I got a call from the colonel that Justice Jackson is arriving at noon and I am supposed to go with him to meet him for him to look over my prisons and my courts." And it was a month or two later that then Justice Jackson decided that was where he would hold the big trials. There's also one letter that says that a colonel came to him and said, "Judge, would you have any interest in serving as one of the prosecutors in the big trials?" And Dad looked at him and said, "That's the last thing I ever want to have to do with." And the man said, "I think, Judge, that's probably," or Major, he said, "that's probably the smartest thing you've ever said."
Mm-hmm. And of course, the Nuremberg trials, notable for the prosecution and execution of some of the most prominent members of the Nazi government there. What else did you distill from the letters about his time in reestablishing or establishing a post-war court system in Germany? What other challenges or glimpses into that time did you get from reading his letters?
The fact that he was being, and their system was being challenged by a lot of the Germans and the Nazi Germans, in that there were curfews established and they would just stay outside just to be belligerent and to rather reject the Allies. People that would come in and try to get away with things. And Dad was very firm, and he just simply talked about what the rules were that they had to follow, and they were going to do it. And in the first month, he wrote a letter a month later after he entered on April 20th, so this was May 20th of 1945, saying that he'd already tried over 350 cases in 30 days.
350 cases in
30 days.
And these cases had to do with?
With curfew violation, rape, black marketing, traffic violations, anything that had to do with civil matters, no criminal matters at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But really upholding the rules and proclamations that the Allies had put into place to get a system started so that the people became easier to live with and to function in their society.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you had any letter that you could read to us verbatim. How many letters were there, for example, in total that you went through?
My goodness, I can't tell you. I have mother made copies for all of us, and I have three large notebooks. Probably each notebook is 3 or 4 inches. And there's some of them very sentimental. He wrote me bedtime stories. He
wrote to you, and you were how old?
I was 5 when he left and 7.5 when he came back.
And this is a time when letters would take perhaps weeks to come to the United States.
Oh, yes, and maybe we'd get 5 in one day and then none for a week. You know, I do have one letter that he wrote on May 20th, 1945, and it's a little bit long, but I think it's very important because it says, "My duties and responsibilities have included, number one, taking over control of all German courts in this city, including a court of appeals for the central third of Bavaria, preserving the court records, procuring lists of all judges, prosecutors, and lawyers, having them all screened by the counterintelligence corps, selecting a committee to supervise repairing the court building, which received a couple of bomb hits. Number two, taking over control and supervision of 4 prisons in this area, preparing a situation report on the conditions existing in the prisons, requiring reports on all prisoners, requiring reports on all employees and having them screened by the CIC as to Nazi tendencies, reviewing the cases of some 105 political prisoners held by the Germans and recommending their release. Number three, acting as judge of a military government court to try all civilians who violate any of the proclamations or orders of the army. To date, I've convicted the 350, as I mentioned. Number four, furnished legal advice to some 40 American officers who supervise the other branches of government. And number five, try to keep hundreds of people out of my office who want advice on how to recover property the Nazis took from them. If they can now take property that belonged to the Nazis, and when can they get to the United States?
Wow. Judy, I'm amazed. It sounds like the work for a battalion of men, not one man.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is. You must be blown away by what the responsibility your father had on his shoulders in the Second World War.
Can I say a swear word on the radio?
You can try it out.
Okay. And he ended that paragraph by saying, "However, I shall close by saying, now that the war is over, I wish to hell I were home." But he didn't get home for another 11 months.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Judy Hamilton Crockett. She's speaking at the University of Iowa College of Law, giving a talk about her father. She's done a lot of research that we're hearing about her father. The talk is titled Memories of a Nuremberg Judge. He was involved in the denazification of the German state of Bavaria after the Second World War, as we've been hearing, reestablishing the post-war court system there, all the challenges, that mighty list of things that he did. Talk to me a little bit about what you know about what was involved in denazification as far as your father was concerned.
Well, it was trying to appoint new judges to take over the court system to be able to run things the way that the Allies had proclaimed they would be, and making sure that all those people were well trained. It was setting up and following through with the proclamations for how the people were going to be lived and be governed. And just establishing a specific system by which they were taught to govern their own people once they were allowed to take the court systems back.
Mm-hmm. And do you know if more or less that court system that was established then is intact today, used in Germany?
I do not know, and I haven't researched that. I really have just done research on what my dad said, but that I haven't had a chance to go into it much farther. I've been doing a lot of speaking to junior highs, to the California Bar Association last year, the California Judges Convention last year, the Iowa Bar, clubs and organizations, and I've done what I want to do, and I think my topic is kind of closed as far as too much more research.
Right. When you talk to kids in junior high or whatever, what seems to resonate with them about a time that must just seem so unimaginable to a young mind?
This particular school that I've spoken to for the last 2 years, to the eighth grade classes, have done a lot of study about the war, and they've been to one of the Holocaust museums in Southern California, and they've done a lot of reading about Anne Frank. But, you know, they're more interested in how did we live as a family. They wanted to know what my mother and my two sisters and I ate. I told them we ate a lot of cream tuna on toast. But the most interesting reaction was last Monday. I talked to a junior high class in Mission Viejo, California, and I have a PowerPoint presentation with some pictures, and one of them shows the family the day Daddy left, which was December 25th, Christmas night of 1943. And I had on a little white wool scarf, and this little boy raised his hand and he said, "Oh, Mrs. Crockett, is that a Muslim scarf?" And I said, "No, that's just an Iowa wool scarf to keep my ears warm in the cold air."
One of the bigger cases I understand that your father tried was of two men who hid and lied about the Holy Roman Empire crown, jewels and so forth here. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that case and the significance of this crown and the jewels.
All of the Holy Roman Empire emperors had been crowned with a specific beautiful crown that had numerous jewels, so gorgeous. And the gowns and the scepter that they held and all of the paraphernalia that went with it had been stored at the Hofburg Palace in Vienna. And in 1938, Hitler decided that he wanted it in Nuremberg, because he was the Third Reich and he was going to be in charge for 1,000 glorious years.
This is the tie-in with the Holy Roman Empire.
Because that was the First Reich.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
So he sent soldiers over and they confiscated all of these things, and they were all brought back in boxes, and they were put under in an area of kind of a mine underneath the Nuremberg Castle. And it was called Blacksmith's Alley Bunker. And after a while, two of the boxes with the more significant valuable things disappeared. Well, it turned out that two men who had been in the city planning office and knew where the bunkers were, and one of them had keys to those bunkers, they decided to take these boxes of the crown and some of the things, and they took them across town, and they buried them in cement wall underneath an elementary school. Well, when the Allies realized that these were missing, they started questioning people about where they were, and they found out who the people were that had the keys and who knew where the bunkers were, and those two men were put on trial. And they were charged with obstruction of justice, and they had given false testimony. So they were in Dad's court in 1945 in September, and they were found guilty for giving the false testimony to the U.S. personnel, and they were sentenced to 5 years in prison, and they were fined $2,500 each, which, of course, in 1945 dollars was a lot more than or a lot less than what it would be today. And you asked me a minute ago about what happened after Dad left. I do know that 20 months after the Allies left, that these two men were pardoned, released, and relieved of all of their fines. And then they took an active part in the rebuilding of some of the buildings and things that were constructed in Nuremberg.
Mm-hmm. Do you know where this Holy Roman Empire crown resides today?
Oh, absolutely. It's back at the Hofburg Palace in Vienna. And my husband and I were there, lucky to be there 2 years ago. And we gave the two original letters of Dad's, which describe the crown and the trials and all, we gave them to the curator of the museum. And he was so nice to visit with us and to take us to see the crown. And we had our picture taken with the crown and some of the artifacts. And it was just really a lovely visit. So people who have a chance to go to Vienna, be sure to go to Hofburg Palace and see all of the regalia from the Holy Roman Empire.
Jude, I understand your father's biography also intersects with a film that some of our listeners may have seen a few years ago, a George Clooney film, Monuments Men.
Yes.
Tell us the tie-in there.
Well, Dad was born in Winterset, Iowa, which is a little town southwest of Des Moines. People know it for the bridges of Madison County and, of course, the movie that was with George Clooney or with Meryl Streep. And also that's where John Wayne was born. And it just happens that the movie is about a man named George Stout, and that's the part that George Clooney played. And I received a newspaper article from a friend who said that the movie was going to be showing in Iowa. I wasn't familiar with it yet, but anyway, it said that he was from Winterset, Iowa. So I wondered if the two families might have known each other. And a couple of days after reading this letter, I was looking through some more of Dad's letters, and I came upon this letter just so untimely, saying, oh my goodness, today, and this occurred in Shrevenham, England, when he was going through that intensive training. It said, oh, today at lunch, I was sitting across from two naval officers, and one of them and I looked at each other, and I realized it was George Stout from Winterset, my high school buddy. And he then wrote, Mother, you'll remember after we both returned from World War I to the University of Iowa, me to re-enter law school and George to go into the art department, that I was so upset because my fraternity wouldn't pledge him. So coincidental to read this in the newspaper from a friend and then find Dad's letter stating that.
That's amazing. Before this conversation ends, I have to ask you about not only about your father's work during the post-war period in Germany, but also he served in World War I. Tell us about your father's service there, and he received a very high commendation.
He did. He left law school in 1918, excuse me, and entered World War I. He just felt such an allegiance to what we were doing and our country. And he became an ambulance driver in France, driving injured soldiers from the front lines where the fighting and the shooting was going on and getting them back to hospital tents for medical care. And it will be actually in May, in two more months, that It will be 100 years since he received the highest honor that the French government gives for service and bravery, called the Croix de Guerre, and that was given to Dad. And there's in my PowerPoint presentation, there's a picture of the article from the Winterset paper showing him in his newspaper, or in the newspaper, in his military uniform in 1918.
Was that for one specific heroic act or for his duty throughout the war?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
Well, you must be very, very proud of your father, even though, as you said, he really never talked about the First World War either.
You know, he was a man who always thought about others rather than himself, and he never liked to bring light to himself or too much accreditation. He was always a very giving person. He was humble, and when he got back to the United States, he did a lot of things here in Iowa City, and probably one of my proudest times was when I was a senior at the university in the fall of 1958. Dad was selected as the most outstanding father at the university and was presented on Friday night by Harry James at a big concert in the Union. And then at the Father's Day football game, halftime, the next day, he spoke at halftime. And then in 1960, he was appointed by the governor of Iowa to be a district court judge here in Johnson County. And he served that until his 75th birthday, which was a mandatory retirement age, and 4 days later, he went back into law practice.
Your father, University of Iowa College of Law graduate, passed in 1975. You've been doing all this research about your father's time in Second World War and so forth, and afterward. If your father were here today, what would you ask him?
Did you know about the death camps?
Why is that a question for you?
Because I don't know whether he, as a person in his involvement, knew that they were going on, or whether that was something that was even kept away, because he was in the restructuring of the courts, and that was probably a different part. I'm sure that he knew about it, but I'd like to ask him, what did you know, rather than did you know, what did you know, or what did you find out?
Mm-hmm. And you put a lot of energy in this as a proud daughter of this man. What is the great satisfaction for you in doing this?
The thing that I get out of it is, and it was really motivated by a letter that I got from the National World War II Museum, which is a wonderful thing to visit in New Orleans. And they said to me that the stories of the men who fought in the war must be told and told again, because there are lessons about courage and sacrifice that no generation can ever afford to get. And so since he was a part of it, I think it's my responsibility to let those generations know what some men did.
Okay. Fascinating work you've done. Thank you for sharing some of it with us, Judy Hamilton Crockett. Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be back in the town where I was raised.
My conversation with Judy Hamilton Crockett about her father, Clarence Hamilton, better known as Claire Hamilton, who served in the First World War, the Second World War, and was a University of Iowa law graduate. Judy came back to Iowa to speak at the law school about her father's work. Coming up after a short break, I talk with Chris Clearfield, a former derivatives trader. He's co-author of Meltdown: Why Our Systems Fail and What We Can Do About It. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.